You are about to hear another in the series, Voices from the Mighty Pen Project, on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. The Mighty Pen Project was founded by Richmond best-selling author David L. Robbins, in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial, to provide writing instruction to those who have experienced our nation's military events, either through their service or as a supporter of the military. Each of those involved in the Mighty Pen Project have a personal story to tell. The Mighty Pen Project teaches them how to tell it. In the next few minutes, you will hear two stories. The first is by Larry Meyer, who is with us in the studio. Larry, describe what you're going to read.
I'm writing an article that kind of talking about myself coming home from Vietnam and meeting with another vet at the vet center who was probably in the same boat as I was and was having, after many years, still dealing with the war and its after effects.
What do you call it?
Quantry Rain. My day had finally come. Received orders. Leaving the battery and going home. Goodbye, Vietnam. But not before the Army could get their last shot at me. I had spent days in a funky oak club in Da Nang, drinking bourbon with an alcoholic dog whose name is lost, as were my hours there. Then I heard, "Meyer, report to the company for your boarding pass." It was like a dream, but don't pinch me. I'm getting on the Freedom Bird. I'm going back to the world. Wow, the sensation when the plane lifted off and my body was no longer connected to Nam. Can't be described, simply because it was beyond my feeble ability to understand. As the world below changed from green to blue, it was time to revisit all those plans I dreamed for 12 months. I'm not sure what they were exactly, or if I could even do them all. Most likely not. But I did know for sure I would hit the road running. Picking up where I left off, life would not be good. It will be great. But there's a sad truth. You can't return to your past. Too much has happened in between, and I was not the same. I didn't even know it. When I got home, my mom was the first to notice something was not right. She thought I would arrive home, get out of uniform, and be out the door. She asked, "Why don't you leave the house? Why don't you go out with your buddies?" Of course, Mom didn't know it was safer to be hunkered down with General Ben, the legendary rat of the DMZ. Mom questioned, "Why was I staying up after the test pattern came on the TV?" But Mom, I thought, I had to be up. The North Vietnamese night crew would be dropping in 122 soon, just like they did the previous nights. But then I felt I had not changed. Everything was the same. As time went on, I did get together with my best buddy, Doug. "Hey, Larry, great tan there. What you been doing?" Silence. Better not answer that one. Even so, what would I say? Or once at a party and a champagne cork goes off behind me. Great fun to see me jump. Great fun for everyone except me. Yeah, I know if you hear the whistling, your name won't be on it, but better not take any chances. Why am I having cold sweats while in Woody's in Tyson's Corner at Christmas? Guess it's tough enough to keep your eyes on a few villagers, but a crowded store? Can't do everything. But hearing others berate my service, that was the worst. I felt I did what I was asked of. I was not a hero by any means. I just did the best I could. I felt pride in that. But not all agreed. Being asked in a Cincinnati airport while in uniform, "How many babies did you kill?" Or on a job interview, "We don't hire people with your skills." But to hear from people dearest to you, now that's another level. Dad and the Signal Corps general friend mocking my service by saying soldiers in Nam didn't know how to fight. If it was WW2, it would have been different. How do they know? Neither ever felt a bullet go by them in any war. It just hurts. So, over time, I learned to stay under the radar. The possible exception was my old field jacket, stripped down to be as plain as possible. But like Peter, I could not deny myself. It was who I am, plain and simple. But the field jacket wanted its insignias back. Like the field jacket, the war was pushing back at me. Then something happened. Those many years of denial collapsed. Some 15 years after leaving the Nam, Vera, my wife, and I were flipping through the channels, going from Moonlighting to Dynasty to whatever, trying to find something to waste our time on. Then we hit Channel 23, PBS, stopping at a live forum at the University of Wisconsin. A roundtable of a bunch of vets who were talking about the war's impact on their daily lives. Why? I don't know, but I was drawn to it. These were regular folks as far as I could tell, nothing special. They acted like me. Not Rambo stuff, you know, heading down to the local bar and going commando on everyone there. No, regular stuff. And I wasn't even sure what that meant. Maybe it was living on the edge. Sure, why gas up when the yellow light is not on? Maybe it's just being alert, where I sit in a restaurant, up against the wall, so trouble can be spotted. Maybe it's avoiding memories. I was so terrified to visit the wall that it took me several visits to walk past all those names in tears. But like everything on PBS, the program had an agenda. Pushing the Vet Center. I never heard of it, but I saw an 800 number. No way, not for me. I discovered that the VA's answer to PTSD was handing out pills. The answer to all that ails you. As could be expected, vets weren't going back. Maybe they found a nickel bag to be a better substitute. There was definitely less paperwork. So the VA began storefront counseling centers. On a lark, I called the Richmond Center on Franklin Street. I thought, why am I doing this? I was ready to hang up if anyone answered. What am I getting into? I made the call and stayed on the phone. I'm Larry, and I'm a vet. That has a nice ring to it. On the other end was Gloria. Welcome home, came back at me. The power of those words, unbelievable. I had no idea of what to do next. It was not supposed to happen this way. Definitely out of my comfort zone. Fortunately, Gloria took over from there. Got me an appointment. Doomed. What have I done? Now I have to show up. The initial counseling was with Gloria. What was the purpose? Guess to find out if I qualified as Nam crazy. Evidently, I made the grade. I was put into a group to do whatever groups do. Dan, the center team leader, led the group. He had the credentials, a PhD, Silver Star, and a Purple Heart. And what a bunch it was. The group had the usual suspects, grunts and Marines. However, the tales were not all about being in the bush. Gramps was a B-52 pilot, tormented by innocents who received his payload. Top, a Marine's Marine in my book, he felt that he had failed to prepare his recruits well enough. Dave, whose dad couldn't talk to him about the war, later to find out they were both Screaming Eagles, Oshawa Valley, Bestone. A true living saint was Martha, a triage nurse. What more can be said about her? Then there was Roger, I had a connection. Served in the DMZ, with the first of the 5th MEC, northernmost. Roger was in Papa Company, 75th Rangers. I am sure he got close and personal with the local bad guys along Rocket Ridge that extended up to North Vietnam along the Blue Line. I was with Charlie Battery, 5th of the 4th Artillery. Even though I never set foot on Rocket Ridge, I knew it well. The NVA there delighted in putting as many 122 craters as possible inside the wire of Charlie 2, our home. To put it mildly, our group was not shy about talking about our experiences. Dan was the catalyst, had a knack about letting us feel free to let it out, and we did, maybe sometimes to Dan's chagrin. Not all of us. Roger was like a clam, but we all knew he had stories. You could see it in his face. As silent as he was always there. Even if he just sat there, something was happening. Just what it was, who knew? I wished he would open up, but that wasn't happening. One dreary, overcast Saturday in February, I got a phone call out of the blue from Roger. I answered, "Hey, what's up?" He started babbling about this, about that, and a lot of nothing. My only thought was how to end the conversation. I just didn't have time. Why did he have to be bothering me? There are other guys who you could have called. Then, looking out the kitchen window, I saw it. Hard to make it out at first, but there it was. A very fine mist. "Roger, is it the rain?" Sort of grunted, "Yeah." And the realization was there, why he called me. It was Quantry rain. This was not the hard monsoon I lived with as an FO in the 4th Infantry down south. No, this rain was worse than that. It went on for 2 or so months, from somewhere in December to February. Everything was damp. Poncho liners would stick to you when you tried to sleep. So bad, a few gun bunnies had Mamasan and Camlo dry their jungle fatigues over water buffalo chips. That was true desperation. Yet, going out to the perimeter at night was a nightmare. We had to cross a tank trail, churned to soup by M48s. One wrong step and your boot could be sucked off. It was Quantry that taught us all about war. No more John Wayne stuff. Audie Murphy, forget it. This was the real deal. Kill or be killed. Survive at all costs. If you think only about yourself, you'll never make it home. Surviving was all about working for each other. War is the ultimate team game. So the irony was that before going to Nam, some kids couldn't drink from the same water fountain in Roanoke as I. We learned to share canteens. Color of skin didn't matter if you were to watch each other's back. Yet we weren't that good at looking after each other. We failed. Once at Lang Vae, a howitzer blew up. It was bad powder, as I understood it. The breech block went through the floor of the cab. It was buried deep into the ground. The round never left the tube. The three gunners vanished. Not a trace. Almost. I heard, "LT, what do I do with this?" In his hand was part of a jawbone. There were three guys, and all I get is this. Yet it was the Holy Grail. The difference between KIA and MIA. We failed them. We didn't live up to our part of the deal. I couldn't change that. We said, "Don't mean nothing." But we didn't fail this last request. They did go home. Roger called several more times. Unknowingly, we started to open up. both of us. After all, I probably was no better than he was. Out came people we knew, places we'd been, and things we did. More importantly, without knowing it, we shared the deeper meaning of it all. What we said to each other and what these stories were have been lost in many years of memory. Does it matter if we forgot? Not really. The memory of where this led us is what counts. Both of us saw a path finding shelter from the storm, shelter from that Quantry rain.
Larry Meyer reading his story, Quantry Rain. Larry, some of the things you mentioned while you were reading, were you surprised that you and others were reviled when you came back to the States?
Yeah, I think so. When we got off the plane, I mean, I think the only thing we were looking forward to was just going home. You know, we felt proud of what we did, but, you know, the reaction, yeah, that was kind of a kicker.
The reason I was wondering is there certainly was a lot of controversy about the Vietnam War in the United States, but had any of that reached you while you were in Nam?
Not really. I mean, we got the Armed Forces Network and the, you know, paper and everything else, but what we picked up on was really the futility of a lot of things we were doing. There really wasn't a purpose. We definitely picked up on the fact that of the civil rights movement and the unrest there, that had a big effect on a lot of us over there, just in our interactions with each other. It was mostly in the rear area that took place. In the field, you had to stick up for each other. That's how you got out of the place.
Larry, you said Vietnam changed you. In what way?
You look at things so much differently. Things, I mentioned in the paper there, the don't mean nothing. That was a very caustic thing about if somebody got killed, it just didn't mean nothing because we had to go on. But don't mean nothing also meant to us that things that are important to a lot of people are just not important anymore. You got to really look at the real background on it.
Thank you, Larry. Larry Meyer, who read his story, Quantry Rain. You are listening to Voices from the Mighty Pen Project on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. Now, I promised you two stories. Also with us in the studio is Aaron Mahone. Aaron, you're going to read a story by one of your fellow writers on the Mighty Pen Project. I take it that you have written, too.
Yes, I have. I am currently the only non-veteran, the only civilian in the group, and it has been a wonderful learning opportunity for me as a writer, but it's also been a wonderful opportunity for me to get to meet these incredible veterans from all different branches of the service, you know, all different times in which they've served, and I've never spent so much time with a group of, you know, just veterans and me, and they're amazing, they're wonderful writers. But they're also just incredible people.
You've picked up a few pointers too, obviously.
I have, yes. It's just been a fantastic experience.
Now, you're not going to read your own story. You're going to read the story of someone else.
Would yes.
you tell us about what you're about to read?
Sure. I'm reading a piece by Beth Lichty. She is one of the vets in the program. And she's written this piece called Packers, which is incredibly powerful. And I'm really honored to have the opportunity to read her work.
So here is Aaron Mahone reading Packers by Beth Lichty.
The old young soldier nods approval as Elsie slips on the Packer boots. In a Western store a few miles from the Las Vegas Strip, she struts, modeling the $100 ropers. His blue eyes grin. Right out of the box, the boots fit like she'd worn them for years. Comfortable. Like the feel when he asked to sit by her on the beach a few weeks earlier. They clicked. Chucking and jawing about sergeant's duty in the peacetime army of the late 1990s. Unlike her, he'd made rank fast after several tours and time in the first desert war. While she's a scrapper who bucks the system, he games the system. His devil-may-care approach with bawdy jokes and stories plays to an audience. Elsie has few stories, so she likes to listen to his. She wishes she was carefree like him, instead of straining under the weight of the rucksack strapped to the back of her brain. Out of the blue, he says, I'd like to buy the boots for you. The unexpected offer strikes her as extravagant, like him. She never spent that much money on boots. Maybe he expects something in return. Really? Maybe. All right, okay, but I don't want to owe you anything. You sure I won't owe you anything? No, Elsie, you won't owe me anything. During a long-ago summer at the 2x7, Elsie bought her first boots with her own money. A pair of brown and buff Abilene's. Lately, though, she could poke her finger through the matching holes in their soles. Water and mud seeped in. The Abilene's moved toward the back of her closet. The new boots show up at the right time. Heavy stitching on the Packers joins two shades of brown, oil-tanned leather, blood red and chocolate, like the old young soldier and his past. Back in Southern California, on many days after duty hours, Elsie slips on the boots and drives inland to Santiago Canyon. The supple leather snugs so dirt and pebbles don't harass her toes and ankles. Inch-high heels with a cowboy slant keep her feet from sliding through the stirrups of her bighorn. Life-saving when her bay mare bucks at a rattler or bolts from the breeze, slapping an oak branch alive. For hours, she trots dusty, single track up and down rocky hills, canters grassy meadows, and inches through cold creeks. The trail eases, the throb, and the pinch caused by that darn ruck. She sets aside bits of time for the old young soldier. He doesn't ride. Sometimes he drives the truck and trailer, which he loves, but he's rather reckless, sharp on the curves and fast on the straights. Elsie passes a blue streak of this and that on the Southern California coast with the old young soldier. He makes her laugh and even forget the ruck once in a while. As expected, she receives orders. Elsie hugs him so long, accustomed to moving out alone, she prefers not to take chances. Elsie keeps the Packers, which sit in front and center in her closet. When she pulls them on, she reminisces about drinking and rolling her time away with that old young soldier. A sweet memory. But then a twinge smart, so she recalls the one time he about-faced to serious. Haunt in his blue eyes, heavy sigh in his voice. I was standing on the runner of the truck. I looked at Hackett, blood spattered on him all over the cab. His eyes were empty. I shook him. His head fell forward and hit the steering wheel. The old young soldier pauses. I jumped off, ran, and took cover. The tanker exploded, pieces scattered everywhere across that stinking sand. There was nothing I could do. There was nothing I could do, reverberates, colliding with the ruck. Like the old young soldier, she senses most everyone humps a ruck. Heck, soldiers brag about whose is heaviest. Frequently, the gargantuan ruck on the back of Elsie's brain cinches tighter, rubbing blisters into her consciousness. On occasion, the maniacal ruck grows superhuman arms and hurls rocks her way, hitting or tripping her. Elsie tries not to flinch. She takes cover with long hours at work, followed by tall shots of tequila. Elsie reports for duty in South Korea. Crazy 12-hour days, 6 days a week, to the field and back again. A year slips by. Elsie returns to an assignment in Northern California. Endless reports and briefings replace field time. Making rank isn't what she expects, but she racks up a reputation for getting the job done. Ah, but those Packers. They pull double duty in the evening. A brush shine readies them for two-stepping over many a honky-tonk floor. Along the line, she hears the old young soldier married a blonde, uptown civilian. Two more years slide by, and Elsie accepts orders to Virginia. Across the country, up the ladder, but her heart isn't in it. Reports and briefings multiply. The Packers spend more time in the closet than on her feet. She raises her hand and deploys to the desert. Interminable hours, little sleep. Her insides rock and roll from untreated water and missions where a wrong turn may kill or maim. Unruly temper, stiff words, heat, anger, and pain distract many by her side. She considers the old young soldier. In an instant, it seems she returns stateside. She does her duty as the present evaporates along with her age. The day arrives when Elsie takes off her combat boots for the last time. She remains in Virginia and signs up for a desk job 8 hours a day. Civilian life twists a different way. The Packers find her feet again. Astride a black appy gelding with an attitude, she competes on Shenandoah Trail. 25 miles, 30 miles, then 50 miles at a stretch. The miles replace the long hours, drinking and two-stepping. But she can't shake off that ruck. Worse, its cinch tightens. About the same time, almost as if in competition, the packers conspire. At first, an ill-fitting feel when she slips them on. Annoying turns to uncomfortable, especially in the saddle. Uncomfortable rages into pain that shoots from the ball of her right foot up her leg, takes her breath away. Like the ruck, the bursts of pain spark without warning or routine. No help from doctors. Buckets of ice water, stacks of heat pads, and handfuls of Motrin have little effect. One doctor acts as though he thinks the pain in her foot is really in her head. Jerk. Eventually, the pain bolts from her foot through her leg no matter what pair of boots or shoes she wears. Screaming like a hyena or whimpering like a pup only irritates those around her. Pain beats desire. The packers drift to the back of the closet with the Abilenes. She turns the gelding out to pasture. The ruck pummels her days and suffocates her nights. Can she hang on? Elsie reads on the internet that foot pain lasting more than a few weeks should not be ignored. Is the same true for a ruck strapped to your brain? It's been more than a few years, so she relents and hobbles her way to Dr. Smith. See here? Mr. Morton and his neuroma moved into the nerves of your foot, between the second and third metatarsal. Over time, Mr. Morton expanded his real estate. Not uncommon for someone your age, but nothing you can do to a victim, the good doctor tells her. Vindication. The pain is real and not in her imagination. Let's try an injection, offers the doctor. At this point, Elsie will try anything. The shot bites when the good doctor plunges the 2-inch needle into the nerve. No relief. Well, it's time to excise Mr. Morton and his neuroma. Elsie can't say yes fast enough. Maybe she should be just as gung-ho to lose the ruck. Under operating room lights, the good doctor cuts Mr. Morton out in less than an hour. 2 weeks recovery and Elsie's foot pain vanishes. Why did she wait so long? After her gait returns to normal, Elsie digs around in the closet and drags out the packers. Tempting, but what if the pain survived? She inspects the dusty 20-year-old boots. As she brushes the worn brown leather to a shine, thoughts flicker of the young, old soldier and the laughs they shared. Did he hang on to the blonde? Did he hang on? Elsie pulls on the packers. Familiar, soft leather hugs her feet and ankles. She wears the old boots for a couple of hours, walking slow, then fast. Even a jaunty two-step. Good old Dr. Smith. Elsie reflects. The doctor's expert hands fixed her foot, but she realizes she chose to go to the doctor, and then she chose to have the doctor operate. What if she chooses to cut the ruck loose? Would it slip away as easily as the neuroma severed by the scalpel? Maybe she would try.
Thank you, Erin. You have just heard Erin Mahone reading a story by Beth Lichty entitled Packer. Both Erin and Beth are participants in the Mighty Pen Project. And in case you tuned in during the middle of this broadcast, let me tell you the significance of the Mighty Pen Project. It was founded by Richmond best-selling author David L. Robbins in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial to provide writing instruction to those who have experienced our nation's military events, either through their service or as a supporter of the military. Each of those involved in the Mighty Pen Project have a personal story to tell. The Mighty Pen Project teaches them how to tell it. Now, you may not realize it when you hear these stories on the radio, but for many who wrote them, this is the first time in perhaps 18 years that these vets have written about their experiences. What you just heard is one in a series of programs, Voices from the Mighty Pen Project on the Virginia Voice. For the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.